taking a trip on a plane the other day, just wishing that I could get out. When the man next to me saw the book in my hand and asked me what it was about. So I settled back in my seat, a bestseller, I said, a history and mystery in one. Then I opened up the book and began to read from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. He was born of a virgin one holy night in the little town of Bethlehem. Angels gathered round him underneath the stars, singing praises to the great I am. He walked on the water, healed the lame, and made the blind to see again. And for the first time here on earth, we learn that God can be a friend. And though he never ever did a single thing wrong, the angry crowd chose him. Down the road and died on the cross, and that was the end of the beginning. That's a Bible, he said, and I've heard it all before. I've tried religion, it's shame and guilt, and I don't need it anymore. It's superstition, a made-up tale, just to help the weak to survive. Well, let me read it again, I said, listen closely, this is gonna change your life. He was born of a virgin one holy night in the little town of Bethlehem. Angels gathered round him underneath the stars, singing praises to the great I am. He walked on the water, healed the lame, and made the blind to see again. And for the first time here on earth, we learned that God can be a friend. And though he never ever did a single thing wrong, the angry crowd chose him. And then he walked down the road and died on the cross, and that was the end of the beginning.
Exactly. Derek walked in as I was prepping and I was playing that song. He's like, I haven't heard that song in a long time. If you didn't pick up from the perm and the red suit and the other clues that came out late 90s, early 2000, I heard it for the first time in 2001 when I was a freshman in college. And I just thought it was a fun catch-up for where we are in the book. And I cut it right at the three-minute mark. And I say this with all the sarcasm I can muster, because the AV team has told me to cut it 3 minutes and not because I'm saving something for next week at all. I thought it was a good refresher for where we have come so far in Mark, and actually where we're going to end this week in Mark is right where that song cut off. Okay, it's just that one went out. I didn't know if that one went out on me too. We're going to be right where that song cut off at the end of where we are today, and then we'll see what happens next week. But we have been looking at the story of Jesus Christ through the eyes of the Apostle Peter, as written by John Mark. And I don't know if something's kicking the HDMI cable up there, Pete, but I keep losing signal back there. I may have to go off of these. But we have seen the story of Jesus Christ through the eyes of Peter, as written down by John Mark, one of the people who would have followed Jesus with Peter. We have been seeing that he is writing to primarily a Gentile audience as he is explaining things as he goes that the Gentiles would have needed filling in for them that the typical Hebrew audience wouldn't have needed. And he's trying to answer this question, who is Jesus? And the really neat thing about today's passage where we're going to end at the end of chapter 15 is who Mark gives the final word on this topic to. As he's trying to answer this question of who is Jesus, the person who gets the final say, the final person who declares who Jesus is a real interesting thing to note as we go through. But ultimately, the question Mark is trying to have us answer as we go through is, who is Jesus to you? What do you do with Jesus? Not because we get to say who Jesus is, but because we do get to decide what we're going to do with that information as it's presented to us. So with that, we're going to jump in. We're going to finish up chapter 14 this week, and we're going to try to march our way all the way through chapter 15. So we are going to move at a slightly faster pace today. like Mark does, because he starts with this and immediately. And this is your last reminder, because next week is the last week of Mark. If you've been trying to count and keep track of how many times the word immediately shows up in the book of Mark, you got one more week to figure it out, because next week, if you come to me with that, you will get a prize. All right. And immediately, while he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. But the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I will kiss is the man. Seize him and lead him away under guard." And when he came, he went up to him at once and said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. So what's interesting here to me is the fact that, first, if I think of somebody coming to arrest a person, who is the first person that comes to mind? Who's going to come do the work of arresting? You're going to think soldiers, right? You're going to think policemen. You're going to think like law enforcement. So it's already a little weird that the crowd with swords and clubs is coming from priests and scribes and elders. So think like pastors and writers and like deacons coming to arrest Jesus. Like it's already a bit of a juxtaposition here. Now, what it's actually saying is that it is a crowd that is sent by them. They would have like drudged up this crowd, but priests and scribes and elders should not be in any way involved in the process of going and arresting somebody. They certainly wouldn't be doing this by cover of night. But they have one of his inside crew, and the point that Mark's trying to make, and he's been making it through chapter 14, he's going to make it again here in a few minutes, is they are trying to do this in a shady way. They are trying to arrest Jesus in a way that the general population, the public, doesn't find out what's going on. So they've got one of his insiders, and he comes, and they're going to arrest Jesus. And he does this with a kiss. This is how he indicates in the cover of dark, when everything is dark, who the right one is. Who is the right bearded man that they are there to arrest? And so they give him a kiss, lets him know who it is, and they come in to arrest him, and they lay hands on him, and they seize him. But one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus said to him, "Have you come out against me as a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled." And they all left him and fled. So a few things here. First, I love this indication here that this is absolutely Peter telling the story. Because right here in the first verse, it is again an absence of information that we have from other gospels. If you've grown up in church and you've heard this story told, something is missing here. Because it says, "And they laid hands on him and they seized him, but one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear." We all know this story, right? We all know one who did it, Peter. Peter's the one who drew his sword, struck the high priest, cut off his ear. We also all know what happened next, right? Jesus put it back on and rebuked Peter, saying, "If you live by the sword, you die by the sword," right? Not here. Peter just moves past that. He's like, yes, this really brave person who was traveling with Jesus drew his sword and went to battle for Jesus because he said, "I would never leave you, Jesus. Even though everybody else runs away, I would stand with you. I would defend you." And that's exactly what he did. And he cut off the soldier's ear. Wasn't he a great guy? Moving on, let's not cover everything that happened after that. We'll let the other gospel writers tell that part of the story. And Jesus says to them, "Have you come out against me as a robber?" What Jesus is pointing out here is exactly what I was saying in that previous slide. It's like, look, I was with you every single day. Every single day this week. I have challenged you publicly. I have confronted you publicly. I have everything that I have said, I have done so publicly in the temple. You could have arrested me at any point in time. But now, on the day we're celebrating the Passover, you come to me after dark, find me in the woods, as I'm praying with my closest friends, and you have to use one of my closest friends to get to me. Like, Jesus is pointing out, this is shady, guys. You should see that this is not above board. But then where Jesus ends this thought is, but let the scriptures be fulfilled. He says, but obviously this is how it had to happen because the prophecy of the Old Testament, because it was prophesied, because the Bible said this was how it was going to happen, he's like, this is what's going to happen. Let the scriptures be fulfilled. And at that point, when the disciples hear Jesus say, okay, I am not going to fight this. I am going to let scriptures be fulfilled as it's written, when he has told them through the last 3 years, look, I am going to die. I'm going to be killed. I'm going to be crucified. When he finally allows them to take him so that scriptures may be fulfilled, that is the point that all his apostles, all his followers leave. They leave and they flee and they run away. And it's here that I think Peter gets a little revenge, because this is the phrase that only shows up in Mark, and teenage boys find this next verse very funny if you don't know why it's this. And a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body, and they seized him, but he left the linen cloth and ran away naked. Why, Mark? Why is this in here? The only thing I could think is Mark is sitting with Peter, and Peter is telling Mark his story, and is believed that this young man that is referenced here is Mark. And I can see them just having this conversation where Mark's like, so, well, Peter, we're not really going to tell the rest of your cutting off the ear story. We're going to leave it there. Okay. But we are going to tell everything that comes next, right? And if you don't know where we're going next, is to see how Peter, more than any, after making such a bold claim that he would stick by him no matter what, more than any of the others, like openly and publicly denies Jesus. He's like, we're going to tell that whole story, right? And Peter's like, yeah, we can tell that whole story, but we're putting this line in here because, Mark, I was there. You ran away too, and it was kind of funny. All right, so this is years after they're telling this story, and Mark puts this in. It's the only reason I could think it's in here, but it's just always brought me a chuckle every time I read that section. And they led Jesus. He moves right into, and they led Jesus into the high priest. And the chief priests and the elders and the scribes, they came together, and Peter had followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. Two things here. First, I think Peter actually gets a worse rap than he deserves. Because verse 54 says that he follows him at a distance, but he follows him right into the courtyard of the high priest. None of the other apostles are doing this. There is some evidence in the other gospels that John also accompanies at least this far, if not even a little bit farther. But a majority of his followers flee. We just saw that. They flee, they run away, and they leave Jesus stranded. Peter also runs, but he seems to follow him at a distance and go and put himself into dangerous territory, whereby if Jesus is going to be condemned to punishment or to death, Peter's close enough, and he would have been recognizable enough that he would have been at risk of the same punishments. So he is following farther than most while still at a distance. And the other thing that I think is interesting in this section, he's going to double up on it here in a second, is that the chief priests and the whole council, they're seeking testimony. They want to put Jesus to death. They don't just want to punish him. They want him gone. But as hard as they looked, as hard as they searched, they could not find anyone to come bear witness against Jesus that was truthful. They found no cause to put Jesus to death. Look, one of the things that we know now more than at any other point in history, because of the way media is, because of the way the internet is, because of the way the world is just way smaller than it ever has been in history, is if you look into somebody's life hard enough for long enough, you can find something to accuse them of. That is not difficult. We have seen, if you look long and hard enough, it is always possible to find something somebody does not want out there. But when they went to look into Jesus' life, when they were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands. Yet even about their testimony did not agree. Many people were coming forward to lie about Jesus, which is interesting because while they're looking for something that is shameful enough that Jesus could be accused of it, they're actually breaking one of the Ten Commandments in bearing false witness against Jesus. They're doing the very thing that they're trying to accuse him of, but they aren't even getting it right. As they're sharing this testimony, they're not even quoting him correctly, and they're not even in agreement with one another about the thing that Jesus did. They could not find anyone to actually bring a real accusation against Jesus. And the high priest stood up in their midst and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." See, they couldn't trap Jesus in a lie, so they trap him in the truth. They know that he has made this claim all throughout, and anyone who claims that Jesus never claimed to be God, Jesus never claimed to be one and the same as God the Father, there are so many verses as you go through the Gospels where he does that directly and clearly, to the point that when the priests could not trap him in a lie, they just asked him to tell them again, "Hey, are you the Christ? Are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of God? Are you God?" And Jesus' response to them is to not hide. It's not to run away or to lie. It's to answer them truthfully for the first time. It says that he remained silent up until this point. He made no answer. He was prepared for them to bring false accusation against false accusation against false accusation and not defend himself. But here, when they ask him just point blank, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one we've been waiting for? Are you God?" His response is, "I am." He actually responds with the sacred name of God that they would have revered and would not have even used, much less claimed for themselves. He responds with, "Yes, I am. And you will see the Son of Man. You will see me seated at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." Says, "Yes, I am absolutely God, the Messiah, the one who is here to save the planet." Which kind of turns into their last chance to turn back. And instead, the high priest tears his garments and says, "What further witness then do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?" And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and cover his face and strike him, saying to him, "Prophesy." And the guards received him with blows. See, this is their last chance to acknowledge, as Jesus says clearly, "Yes, I am the Messiah. I am the one who's here to save the world. I am your king. You should absolutely accept me as your God." But because they declare that it's a lie, they said they hear this, and having heard his blasphemy, which would mean that he is claiming to be God when he is truly not, he tears his garments. He mourns, and they condemn him as deserving death. And they start this process of torture. And as Peter was below in the courtyard, watching all this happen, seeing all this happen, seeing what is happening to the man he has just dedicated the last 3.5 years of his life to, be beaten, be falsely accused, hearing Jesus claim the very thing about himself that Peter had declared about him just all the way back in chapter 8, that he is the Christ. He is declaring that about himself now. One of the servant girls of the high priest comes up to him. And seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, "You are also with the Nazarene Jesus." But he denies it, saying, "I neither know nor understand what you mean." And he went out of the gateway, and the rooster crowed. So this girl notices Peter, comes up to him and acknowledges, "Wait, I have seen you with him before. I've seen you with this Jesus guy." And he's like, "Nope, you don't know what you're talking about. I don't even know what you're talking about. How could you possibly think that me, the Jewish guy who's you've never seen around here before, who's not really a part of this crowd, who's just randomly wandered in this one night, I have no idea what you're talking about. It couldn't be me." And the rooster crows. the story doesn't stop there. It goes on to, and the servant girl saw him and began again to say to the bystanders, this man is one of them. He's one of the ones who went with Jesus as they're up there torturing Jesus, beating him, spitting on him. He said, but again, Peter denies it. And after a little while, the bystanders are starting to recognize what's going on, and this little mob starts to form. He says, after a little while, the bystanders again say, certainly you were one of them. You are a Galilean. You don't talk like us, is what they're saying. We recognize you're different. But he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, I do not know this man of whom you speak. And immediately the rooster crowed a second time. Because if you remember what we looked at last week, the prophecy was given. Jesus said to Peter, when Peter declared, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you, I will be with you, and I will follow you, even if that means I'm going to die. And Jesus responded, no, before the rooster crows even a second, and even twice, you'll have already denied me three times. And now that is exactly what has happened. And if you have not picked up on this pattern, we've seen it all through the book of Mark, from Palm Sunday to the Passover to now Peter's denial. If Jesus says it's going to happen, it happens. No matter how much we deny it, no matter how much Peter said, nope, you don't know what you're talking about, Jesus, that's not going to happen. If Jesus says it's going to happen, it's going to happen. So after he denies him the third time, he hears the rooster crow a second time. And immediately, Peter is struck by what has just happened. It's not lost on Peter what he has just done. It's not lost on Peter the fact that Jesus' prophecy just came true, because we see his response. And Peter remembers how Jesus had said to him, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. And he broke down and he wept. All it took for Peter to come face to face with his failure, all it took for Peter to come face to face with his sin, with his denial, was hearing a rooster crow a second time. And in that moment, when he is confronted with what he has just done, his response is to allow it to break him, and he just starts weeping. The interesting contrast here that I don't know that I ever saw until I was looking at this before, because I've heard this story. I remember hearing this story when I was going to Catholic school in like second and third grade, because the Catholic tradition has a few addendums to what we actually see in the Gospels here, where they talk about the fact that at this point Jesus looks at Peter and he cries so much that he indents his cheeks so that are permanent scars. I actually don't know where those stories come from, but they're like drilled into my brain from religion class growing up. But what never got pointed out to me, and I don't know why I saw it until this week, is this sudden switch in Peter's heart, right? One minute he is denying Jesus, and it says that he is building up, like he is calling down curses on himself, saying like, may God send me to hell if this is true of me. I am absolutely not. I am not. And then a rooster crows, and he breaks down, and he just starts weeping. He isn't gone anywhere. The crowd is still around him. The mob that is forming is still right there around him, accusing him of being a follower of Jesus. But having heard that rooster the second time, Peter knows exactly what is happening. He knows exactly what he has done, and it breaks him to be confronted with his sin in such a way. And as soon as it was morning, move into chapter 15. The chief priests held a consultation with the elders and the scribes and the whole council. And they bound Jesus and they led him away and delivered him over to Pilate. And Pilate asked him, are you the king of the Jews? And he answered him, you have said so. And the chief priests accused him of many things. So this is a transition point. Up until this point in the story, he has been before the chief priests of Israel, the ruling body in Jerusalem. They would have been the Hebrew people. But the Hebrew nation was currently being occupied by the Roman nation. And the Romans were the ones who were actually in charge. So while they may have declared him deserving of death, the Hebrew people didn't get to put anybody to death. That had to be approved by the Roman government. So if they were going to do this in such a way that the Romans weren't going to punish them, they had to take him to a Roman court first. So they take him over to Pilate, who is the local official for the Romans, and they present Jesus. And Pilate asks him a simple question. Are you the king of the Jews? And I want you to grab onto this phrase, the king of the Jews, because you're going to see it a lot over the course of chapter 15. It's going to keep coming up for us in different contexts and in different ways. But this first time is Pilate asking Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus' answer to him is, you have said so. He doesn't say yes. He doesn't say no. He says, that is the accusation that has been laid against me. And the chief priests accused him of many things. The chief priests are there trying to tell Pilate all the terrible things, all the false things that they have drudged up against Jesus. And Pilate again asked him, have you no answer to make? See how many charges they bring against you. But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. Jesus wows Pilate not by his wonderful legal argument, not by arguing for his own life, but rather the opposite. By staying silent, it says that Pilate was actually amazed by Jesus. He was found in wonder because Pilate had seen countless people come before him, knowing that Pilate had the final say as to whether they lived or died. He had watched men beg for their lives. He had watched people just try to find any way to get out of punishment they possibly can. He had encountered this day in and day out the entire time that he would have been serving in Israel. But when Jesus shows up, and the high priest is asking for his death, and the scribes and the Pharisees are asking for Jesus' death, Jesus stays silent. It's what Pat was referencing from Exodus this morning, this idea that we stay silent and let God fight on our behalf. In this case, Jesus is staying silent so that God can fight on our behalf. And Pilate was amazed by what he was seeing. Now at the feast, he used to release for them one prisoner for whom they asked. And among the rebels in prison who had committed murder in the insurrection, there was a man called Barabbas. And the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do as he usually did for them. So this was the idea that Pilate would regularly do this to earn favor with the people. As the Roman government is there occupying Israel, Pilate has to rule as a Roman official in a predominantly Hebrew or Israelite population. One of the things he did to garner favor with them was to, at the time of the Passover, he would release a prisoner. And this wasn't Roman law. He wasn't required to do this, but it was something that he did as a favor for them. And at this point in time, he had someone in prison that he kind of knew they might want back. This rebel named Barabbas, who had committed murder and rebelled against the Roman government, a crime that was punishable by death. This man was going to die in the insurrection, which we don't have a full understanding of what the insurrection was, but the people in this period of time absolutely would have known which insurrection he was talking about. That would have been front page news that there was a group of Israelites who had risen up against Rome to try to overthrow the government and had been caught. And Barabbas had been caught and been condemned to death for the murder that he had committed in that uprising. And the crowd came up and they began to ask Pilate, are you going to do that thing for us that you've done in previous years? Are you going to let us release a prisoner? And he answers them saying, yes, I will. But who do you want? Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews? Referencing Jesus. For he perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him released to them Barabbas instead. And Pilate said to them, then what shall I do with the one you call the king of the Jews? See, he's coming to them and saying, look, we all know why Jesus is here. We all know that Jesus is not here because he has done anything wrong. We all know that he is not deserving of death. But really, the only reason he's here, he says, because Pilate, he perceived it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. Pilate's no dummy. He knows what's going on. He's like, it's just these priests are jealous of the popularity that Jesus is amassing unto himself. But the chief priests were one step ahead of him because they had already gone to the crowd and they'd already stirred up the crowd to ask for Barabbas. Why? Because Barabbas is someone who has already participated in an insurrection. See, the Israelite people want someone who is going to lead them out of the occupation that they're in. They want someone who's going to lead the charge and fight on their behalf. So they want Barabbas,
because he's already proven that he's willing to do that. He's already proven that he is willing to murder on their behalf, to kill on their behalf, to go to prison on their behalf, and to go to death on their behalf. And because the Israelites make the same mistake that their forefathers made, and picking the person who is right in their own eyes, they reject the actual king of the Jews for a criminal, for a murderer, for a violent man. They wanted someone who was going to save them from Rome. Jesus was here to save them from themselves. Jesus was here to save them from everything, such that they would never have to have been under Roman occupation or the occupation of any other nation or even the occupation of their own heart and their own sin ever again. But instead, they could only see what was right in front of their eyes, and they chose Barabbas. And they cry out again. Well, he asks them, "What shall I do with this man you call the king of the Jews?" And they cry out, "Crucify him." And Pilate's question to them is this. And Pilate says to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him." So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. As they're crying out, he says, What shall I do with this king of the Jews?" They say, "Crucify him." He asks why. He knows, he's examined Jesus. He knows that the Pharisees, the scribes, the chief priests, they're just making up these charges. He knows they're not real. It's like, he's done nothing wrong. He has not done anything evil. Why do you want him dead? And this is the point in any argument that you know rationality has left the building and we're just making an argument from emotion, because they don't try to answer the question. They don't try to give him good reasons. They just continue demanding the thing that they want. They just want to have him crucified. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is the governor's headquarters, that's where Pilate would have lived. And they called together the whole battalion. And they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him, and they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. So they begin to use this very title that is actually true of Jesus, that he is the King of the Jews. He is the King of all. He is God himself. And they're going to use that title as a way to mock him, as a way to bring him down. They give him a fake crown. They give him a fake robe. And they pretend to kneel down, all the while they're deriding him and degrading him as they beat him to within an inch of his life. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his clothes back on him. And they led him out to crucify him. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross, and they brought him to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. The only thing I find interesting here, because we've heard this story 100 times, is the fact that Simon gets specific recognition here in verse 21. Like, it's interesting that along this path, something that happens is that Jesus becomes incapable, not strong enough physically to carry his own cross, so they grab this guy, Simon, out of the crowd. And I imagine this is Simon is someone that they all know, because Mark, the writer, the author, includes the names of his kids, like, so that they would know exactly which Simon he was talking about. But what's interesting to me is that Jesus, in his weakest point, when he is fighting the hardest battle of his life, as he is being tortured, as he is headed to the cross, God actually doesn't ask him to do it alone. Like, all his compatriots, all the people who'd followed him, all the people who should have been there having his back, they've all fled. They've all left him. And God still has this man standing in the crowd, this Simon of Cyrene, that gets to come alongside Jesus, carry his cross, bear this weight alongside Jesus, who is going to his death. And as a result, he is remembered in the gospel for the rest of eternity. How cool is that? And they offered him a wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him, and the inscription of the charge against him read, the king of the Jews. And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. Mark here is, in his usual form, just plowing through this story as fast as is humanly possible. He talks about him being offered the wine mixed with myrrh. This would have been a form of painkiller to help him go through the pain of the crucifixion. It's a bit of a humanitarian offer, but Mark points out the fact that he did not take it. Two reasons why I think Mark points this out. One, that is not going to help at all with the actual pain that Jesus is dealing with, because as torturous and as humiliating as the cross is, the thing that is really going to weigh on Jesus, the thing that is going to cause him the most pain, is actually the bearing of our sin at this point. At this point, he is suffering the results of all of our sins as he is on the cross, and wine and myrrh isn't going to do anything to deaden that. But the other reason I think he points it out is because previously, in just the previous chapter, he had pointed out the fact that Jesus told the apostles at the Last Supper, as they drank the wine together, he would not drink wine again until he shared it with them in eternity. So when they offer him wine, in fulfillment of his own words, again illustrating yet again in the book of Mark, if Jesus says it, it will happen. When they offer him wine, he will not drink it. And it was the third hour when they crucified him, and the inscription of the charge against him read, and again, the King of the Jews. We don't get it from the Gospel of Mark, but if you look in the other Gospels, what you find is this seemed to be a turning point for Pilate. Because the people come to Pilate and try to convince him, don't put up there the King of the Jews, say that he claimed to be the King of the Jews. And Pilate refuses and says, no, I've written what I've written, this is what we're going to put up there. That the charge against him is not that he claimed to be the King of the Jews. The charge against him is the fact that he is the King of the Jews. And it's a little bit of a shift in Pilate's mindset. And they crucify him alongside robbers. That, again, is a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross. So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, he saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe. And those who were crucified with him also reviled him. And once again, now we have seen the Romans use this title to mock him. Now we're seeing the Jews use this title to mock him. All the while, he is the Christ, the King of Israel. He is everything that he claimed to be, and he will prove that. They say, come down now off the cross that we may see and believe, when in reality, it is by his choice to stay on the cross that proves that he is the Christ. It's his choice to stay on the cross that proves that he is the one strong enough to be called the King of Israel. It's because he chooses to stay on the cross that we can see and believe. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, behold, he is calling Elijah. And if you have studied Greek, if you have studied Hebrew, cool. You probably still don't recognize these words, though, because it's not Greek. In fact, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani is Aramaic, which would have been a very commonly spoken language by Jesus, but probably not by the Romans who were on the hill that day. So they get confused. And as in illustrating once again that Mark is writing to a Gentile audience, not the Hebrew audience that would have actually understood and been able to understand what some of the Aramaic is, he points out to his Gentile audience, they were really confused and they thought he was calling out to this Elijah, because Eloi and Elijah sound similar. They were thinking he must be calling out to Elijah. And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink, saying, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And a curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. So as he cries out, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, this guy says, whoa, He's calling out to Elijah. Let's see if Elijah's going to show up. And he goes and gets him some wine to try to prolong Jesus' life, to see if Jesus can last long enough for Elijah to come save him. But by the time he gets back with the wine, it says that Jesus utters a loud cry and he breathes his last. He dies before the wine shows up. It says, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. This would have been a curtain that stood when the Jewish people would go into worship. They were not allowed to go into the Holy of Holies. This curtain was designed as a separator between where in years past the Ark of the Covenant would have been and the people. So when they went in to meet with God, it would protect them from the wrath of God. It would protect them from the glory of God, because the only person who was allowed to go in was the high priest, and even he was only able to go in once a year after careful preparation. And if anybody went in without going through that preparation who was not the high priest, they'd be struck dead on the spot. So this curtain was designed to be a barrier or protection between God and humans. And at the moment of Jesus' death, it says that curtain was torn from top to bottom, signifying that that curtain is no longer necessary. At the moment of Jesus' death, the thing that separated us from God, our sin, was on Jesus. Jesus was bearing the weight of that sin. Jesus was making things right between us and God. And when he died, he paid that penalty. That penalty was cared for in such a way that humans no longer have anything to fear from God. Humans no longer need to be separate from God. Humans can now be together with God. And the symbol of that was this curtain tearing, not from the bottom up, like some human could do, but from the top down, as only God could do, indicating that God had accepted this sacrifice and that things were right between God and man for the first time ever. And look who it is who acknowledges what has just happened. Centurion. The crazy thing about Mark is, after all the people who have declared who Jesus is through the book, through starting with Isaiah, talking about Mark's point of view, looking at Peter at the middle of the book declaring, "This is the Christ, you are the Son of God." After all the people who have declared who Jesus is throughout this book, the person that Mark chooses to, or Peter chooses to, give the final word on who is Jesus is the very Roman centurion who is there putting him to death. And it's this Roman centurion, through this entire chapter, who has been mocking him using this title. He is the King of the Jews. He is the Son of God. He is the Christ. He is the Messiah. All the mocking, in this instance, having seen Jesus die the way he did, it's that centurion who gets the final say when he says, "Truly, very truly, this man, Jesus, was the Son of God." Says there were also women looking on from a distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James the younger and of Joseph and Salome, and when he was in Galilee, and they followed him and ministered to him. And there were also many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. And when evening had come, since it was the day of preparation, that is the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a respected member of the council, who was also himself looking for the kingdom of God, took courage and went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. And Pilate was surprised to hear that he should have already died. Crucifixion was designed at its core to be a painful and long process, oftentimes taking days for people to die on a Roman cross. So when Joseph of Arimathea comes to ask for the body, Pilate's like, "There's no way he's even dead yet. I'm not going to let you take him off the cross if he's not fully dead, because there's a chance that if he's not really dead, he comes and revives, and then we get to do this all over again, and that we're not going to let that happen." So Pilate is surprised. He does something interesting, because this is a common argument even given today, that Jesus didn't really die, that they just put him in the cool of the tomb and he revived in the cool of the tomb and he came back. But in many of the Gospels, Mark included, Pilate here does something really interesting. It says, and he summons the centurion, and he asks him whether he was already dead. And when he learned from the centurion that he was dead, he granted the corpse to Joseph. And Joseph brought bought a linen shroud and taking him down, wrapped him in the linen shroud and laid him in the tomb that had been cut out of the rock and rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. He does not take Joseph's word for it. He calls in the centurion, a centurion who would have been very acquainted with death, who would have known what death looks like. A centurion at this period of time was a soldier, and soldiers in this period of time did not sit idle. This man would have seen battle. He would have seen death. He would have been very, very familiar with what death was. So when a centurion declared that somebody was dead, that person was dead. And when the centurion tells Pilate that he's dead, then and only then is Pilate assured, yes, he must be dead, and he gives the body to Joseph, and they lay him in a tomb. And that is where chapter 15 ends. So what's our so what? That's kind of depressing. Come back next week. What makes you leave Jesus? For Peter, it was fear. But it can be any number of things that cause us to stray. There can be any number of things that come between us and God. For some of us, it might be fear like Peter. For others, it might be lust. For others, it might be anger. It might be some other form of sin in your life that causes this rift to form between you and Jesus and causes you to go your own way. I encourage you this week to spend some time in prayer about that. If you don't know what is the thing that draws me away, what is the thing that distracts me from you, Jesus, ask him. In prayer, ask Jesus, what is it that I'm missing that is pulling me away from you? Because I assure you, we all have something that will cause us to flee. All 12 of his apostles flee. We get Peter's story more intimately, but all of them leave him at some point. We do too. How do you respond when you're confronted with your sin? How do you respond when someone brings to you the confrontation of your sin? And I think we all respond differently to this. Some of us through anger, some of us through running away and shame and breaking down. With Peter, when that rooster crowed, he responded by breaking down and weeping. Because he was so grieved over the fact that he had hurt his Jesus in such a way that he knew he had done wrong. Here's the cool thing that we see from the rest of that story, though. The curtain has been torn in two. We no longer need to respond with shame. We no longer need to respond with sorrow. We no longer need to respond with grief because of our sin. We need to respond the way God intended us to respond, to take our sin and just give it to him. And say, look, this served me well in the past. I'm done with it. Will you take it from me? Will you get rid of this for me? It's no longer about mourning and weeping our sin, but rather giving it to him and trusting that the curtain is divided. We have nothing to fear from God anymore. We can take our sin directly to him because there's nothing to fear and say, this is yours now, God. I don't want it anymore. With zero fear of condemnation, because that curtain is torn in two. It's gone. So how are you responding to whatever it is that draws you away? And then finally, who is the King of the Jews to you? To the centurion seeing Jesus' death, he knew he was the King of the Jews. As we look in Scripture, I don't know that you can come to any other conclusion than Jesus either is who he says he is, the God, the King of the Jews, the King of us, or a complete and total crazy person or liar. So as you examine the evidence, especially coming into next week, I think we need to all answer this question again. Who is the King of Jews, the Jews to you? And you may sit here and say, but Pastor Kyle, I have been a believer in Jesus my whole life. Great. The question still applies. Who is the King of the Jews to you? He can be your savior, and you can still spend the next 50 years ignoring him. Or he can be your savior, and you can live the next 50 years of your life devoted to him, dedicated to him, actually acknowledging him as the king, the one who is in charge, the one who is leading you, the one who gets to tell you what to do, the one who gets to guide you into all things, because he's the one who cares for you even more than you care for you. But all of it will come down to how do you answer this question. Who is the King of the Jews? Who is Jesus to you? Let's pray. God, that's a lot in a short period of time. But we are just so grateful that you are the one who is in charge. Not me, not the president, not the world, not society, you. You are our king. And even though we fall away regularly, even though we are regularly act as though we're in charge, we acknowledge that when we do that, we are wrong. And we come back and we declare today, you are the one who is in charge. God, I pray that you would lead us and have us submit to you in obedience as the right, the loving, the just, the righteous, the holy, the awesome King of West Middlebury Baptist Church. God, because we want nothing more than that. In your son's name, amen.